From KXCI in Tucson, it is time for the classic pick of the week. Jean Armstrong is filling in for Chris Carey today on the classic pick of the week. Always a delight to have Jean back in the studio. And today he comes in to share some love and knowledge about Blue Oyster Cult. Welcome to the show, good sir.
Thank you, Hannah. It's always nice to be here.
Yeah.
I always appreciate your show.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's exciting when I get to fill in for Chris because usually through whatever means of him suggesting and me suggesting, I get to talk about an album that I like a lot.
Yeah,
the classic pick
out,
of the
right?
week.
Yeah,
is Blue Oyster Cult's Secret Treaties, their third album, released back in 1974, 45 years ago this month. And well, it's especially exciting for me because as I was growing up, I listened to this album quite a bit. It's probably one of my personal favorites, and I always used to try to see Blue Oyster Cult live whenever I had the opportunity, whether it was like a big show in TCC Arena with Cheap Trick, you know, co-double bill.
Oh, yeah.
Or a tiny little poorly attended nightclub show when they were maybe not doing as well.
But you took them on in any context.
Yeah, that was on my birthday, actually,
nice.
Once. And this album was their third album, as I said. Their first two records in the early 70s sowed the seeds for what they would become. But they weren't quite refined and focused yet. And then when they got to Secret Treaties, it was like everything snapped into perfect focus. They're not... Blue Oyster Cult, although sometimes called a heavy metal band, I don't think they were heavy metal.
I always thought that was a misclassification.
I feel like they were somewhat like Thin Lizzy in that they're a hard rock band with lots of versatile parts, even pop music sensibility that had influence on some heavy metal.
I completely agree.
And, of course, later, years after this album was released, they had huge pop hits that we all know and love, like Don't Fear the Reaper and Godzilla and Burning for You. But at this point, they had just found their perfect way of expressing themselves, and it was by combining occult imagery, which was of course tongue in cheek, sci-fi imagery, military history. As you can see on the album cover, that beautiful pen and ink drawing by an artist whose name is here in my notes somewhere depicts the World War II era German jet fighter, the Messerschmitt ME-262, which is, in fact, the title of one of the songs in the album, ME-262.
Okay, so between all those factors, it's downright shocking that this band was so appealing to teenage boys.
No kidding. It's a perfect storm for teenage boys like me. And I think this album is a classic example of the all-killer, no-filler ideal, because it's 8 songs, just under 40 minutes. It's concise. Every song, there's no song that's weak. And they actually, there's no breaks. When you play it on vinyl, there's no breaks between the songs.
Oh, really?
They just move into each other. So it's hard to cue up on vinyl. But on CDs, of course, they're separated into tracks. And it comes from an era when albums were meant to be listened to from start to finish. And, well, in many young, teenage, inebriated parties, that's what we did.
Indeed.
We listened to it from start to finish. But I think the great appeal of Blue Oyster Cult is that they had something for intellectuals, or at least people who wanted to be intellectuals, and for the stoners, and wherever the Venn diagram crosses over.
Right,
between
in between those areas.
And they worked with many outside writers, too. I mean, Eric Bloom, the lead singer, and Donald Rozier, also known as Buck Dharma, did the primary songwriting, but the other members did too. But they also had Patti Smith usually write with them on one song. That's the song that we're going to hear today. Or the rock critic Richard Meltzer, or Michael Moorcock, the sci-fi writer, or their manager, Sandy Pearlman, who also produced their first few albums, including this one. And he later went on to produce the controversial Clash's second album, Give Him Enough Rope, which some people said sort of took the punk out of the Clash, but that's another story. Go ahead.
I was just laughing about the notion of being able to take the punk out of Clash, because I don't think you can do that, actually.
I was just listening to the great Clash History podcast.
Yeah. Oh, that new one. I've been wanting to check that
Chuck
out.
Chuck D's.
Yeah. I can't believe I haven't listened to that
Sandy
yet.
They talked about how Sandy Pearlman, some of the fans felt that Sandy Pearlman took the Clash away from punk.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, he did a great job with Blue Oyster Cult. And the subject matter, sort of adventurous, sort of arty, sort of challenging, and sort of dumb, all in the same time. I mean, the first song on the album, Career of Evil, which we'll hear in a moment, starts out with this couplet. I plot your rubric scarab, I steal your satellite. And then it goes on to more artsy, fartsy, sort of mumbo-jumbo intellectual stuff. And all the albums are great. All the songs are great. And I guess it bears mentioning that one famous metal band, Metallica, chose to cover the song Astronomy, which ends the album, and which we'll hear at the end of the week. And it's a great cover. It's worth seeking out. I will say that it was not a smash hit, this album.
That's what I was just going to ask.
It didn't have any singles.
No singles.
It reached 53 on the Billboard Albums charts, and it went gold in 1982, 18 years later.
All right. So but it's a protracted, great, modified success.
It's a great record for people who like listening intently in whatever state you happen to be. And Rolling Stone in 2002 named it one of the 50 coolest records of all time.
Well, all right then.
So there we go.
Excellent.